Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Coming up this hour, Pennsylvania will lose one congressional seat ahead of the 2022 elections, a potential game changer in state and federal politics. And we'll hear from poet and Penn professor Fatima Shams. Her new book, A Revolution in Rhyme, examines the role that poets, sanctioned by the state, play in Iran's political discourse. But to begin, it seems increasingly likely the number of state universities in Pennsylvania will shrink from 14 to 10. The Board of Governors for the State System of Higher Education has overwhelmingly voted to move forward with plans to consolidate six universities into two regional schools. Bloomsburg, Mansfield, and Lock Haven would combine to produce one, and California, Edinburgh, and Clarion the other. It's a move which is expected to save millions of dollars in a time of declining enrollment. However, faculty, students, and even some board members are expressing concern about the effect this could have on coursework, majors, accreditation, athletics, and host communities. Susan Snyder has reported on this for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and she's here with us now to discuss the details. Hi, Susan.
Hi, thanks very much for having me.
So the consolidation proposal has sparked some pretty significant pushback. But before we talk about this, let's dive some more into the reasons why state officials believe combining these schools is necessary. Enrollment is down by about how much, Susan?
So over the last, since like 2010, enrollment has fallen across the system about 21%. And so it started, it's been over 120,000 back then, and now it's down to about between 93 and 94,000.
And is there any chance this might reverse in the near future? What are we seeing at the high school level in population?
So the problem is, I think they're thinking it will not reverse. And in fact, you know, after 2026, it's looking to get even more, you know, more of a problem, more of an issue, you know, for all colleges. And the fact that the state system schools have continued to drop has been remains a concern. It's also finances. I think, you know, that a number of these schools are sort of depleting their reserves, you know, going through some of their reserves. And so I think that's a concern. I mean, I think when they started talking about this, they were saying, the system officials were saying that the schools were expected to use about $260 million of their $724 million reserves by 2022.
The state system says, you know, consolidating these schools would save nearly $18.5 million over 5 years. But the faculty union president says the act of consolidation will actually cost more. How does this work, and how much more?
So yeah, they're predicting it's going to cost almost like $30 million over the next 5 years, and you know, at 5 years of implementation of it. And you know, the fact is, yeah, they're saying they're only looking at saving about $18.4 million. And I have asked the system about that, and they're saying, well, that's initially, and, you know, savings will continue, you know, going forward, and that the implementation costs are, you know, a one-time thing. But, you know, I do think that the faculty union is really concerned that that the savings that they initially thought they were talking about just aren't looking as big as they initially had hoped.
So, Susan, if this proposal does become reality, let's talk about what consolidation would look like. Would some brick-and-mortar campuses shut down? Would course offerings or majors be slashed or moved around? What might we see?
So what they're saying is that all six of these universities would keep their campuses, you know, keep their sites. But there would be a lot more sharing. You know, they would report to one administration, you know, have one president. But they would be sharing, they would have a unified faculty, a unified curriculum. And one of the things they're saying, which I think has some people concerned, is there will be, you know, perhaps more, you know, online learning. I think, you know, the region with Bloomsburg in, Bashar Hanna, the president of Bloomsburg, has said that, you know, they had done a survey of students and that, you know, students were saying they, you know, were willing to have about 25% of their classes online. And so I think that's kind of what they're looking at possibly doing. So some of these students might, you know, so if you're based at Lock Haven, you might take, you know, a lot of your courses at Lock Haven, but then you might be taking some of your courses online as well.
Have there been, go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, and they also don't know, another big thing in this is they don't know what's going to happen with athletics. I mean, they want all these schools to maintain their athletic teams, but they're waiting to hear from the NCAA on that.
Okay, so that's in limbo then.
Yes.
All right. Are layoffs among faculty and support staff, et cetera, a given here?
So one of the things they said, they were planning to reduce the size of the staff anyway because of dropping enrollment. So, you know, that was something that was going to occur anyway. But the question is, and there's still going to be some loss, you know, especially among administrative levels and stuff in terms of staff. They haven't specified exactly how much. But I think a lot of employees are really concerned about, you know, what ultimately this will mean.
Sure. Is there an ongoing discussion about how accreditation would work for these new regional schools? And any word here, Susan Snyder?
Yeah, so they basically are looking, they're working with the Middle States Commission on Higher Education. They do need to get, you know, approval, and they, you know, they are talking to them, and once they get final approval of the board in July, if the board votes on this, then they would go into that process of getting, you know, new approval for these three new, you know, I'm sorry, these two new accredited universities.
And do we know how long that process would take, getting the accreditation in place?
Yeah, so I think they're hoping that they would have it, you know, that they would, once they apply, that they would have it sometime, you know, they're hoping to put this thing into place possibly as soon as fall of 2022. That's what their timeline is. So, you know, Middle States, I think they were saying, and I can't remember exactly from the last meeting when they were saying they were hoping to hear it, may have been, I can't remember if it was late in the fall or in the spring, you know, 2022. I can't remember when they were hoping to hear. I think it was the spring of 2022.
Have there been decisions made about what will happen to university names like Clarion, you know, California, Mansfield? Do the names remain in play at all, or are there going to be entirely new names for these two regional schools?
So I think they're planning on having new names, but they also want to in some way keep the names of these institutions alive somehow, you know, so that because of identity, and you know, they don't want to lose the identity and the branding of these institutions. So, you know, they're supposed to have two new names, but they're, you know, the campuses themselves may try to, you know, will try to keep the, you know, Lock Haven, Mansfield, Bloomsburg, California, Clarion, Edinburgh alive in some form, just because of identity issues.
It's early, Sue Snyder, but has there been any discussion about how they might market this sort of thing if they're trying to keep the names and yet move forward?
Well, you know, I think that's something that, you know, I think has some of the campuses concerned. In fact, you know, at the state board meeting, state board of governors meeting last week, I think it was a faculty member from Edinburgh who mentioned that already some of the registrations for next year are kind of falling off there. Mm. Like, and they're concerned that that may have to do with the fact that people don't know what's going to happen with these campuses and where they're going to be and how they're going to wind up. And so I think, you know, certainly the system's going to have its work cut out in terms of, you know, trying to figure out how to market these and to make sure that, you know, people want to continue to attend to these campuses.
Yeah. And what about alumni who might be wondering about how all this might, you know, say impact their diplomas? Have we been hearing from them?
Yeah. So I actually sat in on a Zoom meeting that Lock Haven had last week, some faculty and alumni, and definitely hearing concerns there about what it even means for people who've already graduated from there in terms of their degree, the value of their degrees. And so I think, you know, there's definitely seems to be more concerns being voiced, and I think we're going to hear more of that over the next couple months until the board, you know, votes in July and certainly during a couple public hearings that are scheduled in June.
Was Chancellor Daniel Greenstein able to offer any solace here to those who might be concerned about brand loss?
Yeah, I mean, I think what he has been saying is that, you know, this is something, a necessary step, and that he's saying that he thinks these schools are going to come out stronger on the other side, that there will be stronger as integrated institutions than they were, you know, on their own. And certainly, you know, there's other people within the system that have different views of that. And but that is what the chancellor has said, that, you know, this is a necessary step. And that these schools are going to, you know, are going to actually be stronger on the other end.
Is the Board of Governors pretty much on board in entirety here?
So the vote was 17-2 last week in terms of proceeding, you know, going into the public comment phase on this. And, you know, one of the board members who was Representative Tim Briggs, you know, who voted no, just said, you know, he still had more questions. He wanted more answers to his questions, and he wanted to kind of pause on this. You know, the rest of the board, you know, had voted in favor of it. But ultimately, you know, in July, I did hear board members certainly expressing some concerns. So, you know, whether they're going to feel comfortable you know, ultimately approving this in July, you know, remains to be seen. I think a lot will have to do with kind of what answers the system, the chancellor comes out with over the next couple of months and what concerns they continue to hear.
Another concern regards, the host communities of some of these universities. There's concern that consolidation could have a devastating impact on these communities. Tell us about that.
Yes. Yeah, and I think, you know, I mean, that's certainly something that I heard on the Lock Haven call, you know, that there's, you know, for a number of these communities, you know, the university is like a big part of their town, you know, and their economy. And, there was a report that came out last week as well that said, you know, there's going to, you know, a lot of the job loss that's going to occur is going to have ripple effects, you know, and really hurt, you know, these communities. I think the chancellor has pushed back and said, well, you know, that job loss was going to have to occur anyway because of the dropping enrollment. But, you know, ultimately, I think another concern is, you know, what happens if these, you know, what if this doesn't work, or what if, you know, they can't, the rebranding doesn't work and these schools lose even more, you know, enrollment, then what happens? So, you know, I think that's a concern.
Chancellor Greenstein has asked for an increase in state funding of 2% for the system of higher education. And, you know, at first glance, 2% seems like a fairly modest request. But as you note, Susan Snyder, Pennsylvania is nearly last in the nation in state higher education funding. Is the money there to bump up financing even more and perhaps even avoid combining universities? Do you know?
Well, that is certainly, you know, what the faculty union said, that the chancellor should at least be asking for more. But I think, you know, given that we're, you know, in a pandemic yet, and there's been a lot of demands on the finances of the state and, you know, for a lot of needs, I think, you know, the system has said, look, we got to be realistic about what we're asking for here. And you know, because enrollment has dropped as much as it has, we really have to, you know, we have to do what we have to do here and try to make these schools, you know, work better, and that he thinks this is the route to go. So whether you know, I'm certainly the legislature's, I'm sure, watching this, and whether they decide they want to provide more money, I think that would be, you know, something we have to watch.
What are you hearing, if anything, from other universities in the state system, say Westchester? Is there a wariness, you know, maybe we're next, or a sense of relief?
Well, interestingly enough, the state law that was passed that kind of allows this to occur exempted Westchester and Indiana, you know, from consolidation or affiliation. So they, you know, they would not be part of the combinations. But I did hear, you know, at the meeting last week, you know, certainly there's concerns among these schools just about the fact that for so long, some of these schools have struggled, and that's been a drag on the system. And so they've, even though like Westchester's enrollment's continued to grow, you know, they've had to, you know, they're worried that if the system itself can't turn around, it is going to start to really hurt them as well. So that was something, you know, we're hearing from some of those schools as well, even if they're not part of these mergers, that, you know, they could be affected in the long run.
Okay. So again, final vote comes in July, and there will be public hearings ahead of that. Susan Snyder reports for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Okay. Stay with us on the Regional Roundup. We'll be talking about the fact that Pennsylvania will lose one seat in the House of Representatives ahead of the 2022 elections. More to come. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and this is the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. The political landscape will soon shift in a big way in Pennsylvania. Population growth was exceptionally slow over the last decade, according to the census, and so the Commonwealth will lose a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. The implications are enormous. Republicans need to gain just a handful of seats in 2022 to gain control of the House, and in the state itself, where the congressional delegation currently is split evenly among Republicans and Democrats, it's not clear yet which party will end up in the minority in representation. To determine this, the state's congressional map will need to be redrawn, which promises to be a bare-knuckled partisan brawl involving the legislature, governor, and possibly the state Supreme Court. For analysis, we turn to John Micek, editor-in-chief of the Pennsylvania Capital Star. Hello, John.
Hey, good morning, Mary.
Good morning. So Pennsylvania's congressional delegation will shrink in number from 18 to 17. Congressional district boundaries will have to be redrawn. The state legislature draws the map. What will they be looking for as they reshape boundaries? And John, is there a clear starting point in the process?
Mary, if you are a political or board game nerd, this is high season for you because it has a little bit of everything. There's political and partisan tensions. There is the sort of the spatial relationships of moving districts around. And as you said a moment ago, this is going to be a deeply involved partisan fight between Democratic Governor Wolf and the Republican General Assembly, more than likely landing before the state Supreme Court. This is the continuation of a decades-long trend for Pennsylvania. The state has been losing, I went back and checked on this, has been losing in congressional seats since the 1910s. We in fact had 36 seats at the beginning of the 20th century, and have seen that halved in the intervening time, and we'll see the state drop another seat. The question of where that's going to happen is a really great one. All eyes seem to be on Western and rural Pennsylvania, where there has historically been the most population bleed. The National Democratic Redistricting Committee, which is run by the former Attorney General Eric Holder, has suggested axing the 15th congressional district seat held by Republican Glenn Thompson. That is a sprawling chunk of territory across the north central part of the state. Thompson is the ranking Republican of the House Agriculture Committee. He is a big target. Republican strategists have also suggested that you could see the seat now held by Connor Lamb in suburban Philadelphia being looked at, John Joyce near Altoona, Guy Rushenthaler also in suburban Philadelphia, or even Mike Kelly's seat up there in northwestern Pennsylvania coming under scrutiny.
Is it likely we'll see a consolidation of several seats once this happens?
That's a great question. It's going to be a matter of where the biggest population loss is. Historically, and I'm thinking back to the 02 consolidation now, where they pulled then Representative Tim Holden down from Schuylkill County into Dauphin County, setting up a steel cage match with Republican George Gekas. There could well end up being an incumbent versus incumbent matchup as as the state loses a seat and they try to rejigger these maps.
As you mentioned earlier, Governor Wolf will sign off on the new map. And again, he's a Democrat. The legislature is Republican majority. John, do you expect a replay of 2018? Is it really likely in which Wolf and the legislature couldn't agree on a new map after the old one was found to have been gerrymandered and the state Supreme Court stepped in to implement its version?
I was, in fact, talking with somebody, Mary, over the weekend who was around for the last round of redistricting in 2011, and that person has predicted to me that there will inevitably be a deadlock between the Democratic front office and the Republican-controlled legislature sending this thing to the state Supreme Court again. I can't imagine that those two sides, who agree on so little right now, who spent most of the pandemic sparring with each other over reopening questions and executive powers and the like, will easily come to consensus on something as politically charged as a congressional map.
So, after all is said and done, how might redrawing the lines affect political constituency here? You've got Democrats who want to do one thing, Republicans want to do another. Do you see major shifts in population within congressional lines? Actually, political populations within these congressional lines?
Yeah, again, and that's going to depend, I think, Mary, on where the redrawing actually takes place. If that happens in western Pennsylvania and you see some seats in suburban Allegheny County, which is pulled in together, a seat like Guy Regensoler's, which is Republican, and a seat like Connor Lamb's, which is sort of like nominally Democratic, you could see some constituencies sandwiched in together there. I can't. I'm trying to think for the life of me how they would, if the Democrats get their way and Glenn Thompson's seat gets axed, how that would work because that is, again, that is just an enormous seat sprawling across dozens of counties across the northern tier and into north central Pennsylvania. You could see some people, some of those folks pulled down into counties where there might not necessarily be the most obvious confluences of interest. And of course, that's the big test as well. The guiding principles here are to try to keep communities of interest together, to try to not split counties if they can avoid it, and to keep districts compact and contiguous. And when you're in a, you know, we went through an ex episode or exercise rather at the Capital Star where we tried to draw our own maps. And it's a tremendously difficult exercise to honor all of those criteria.
Let's get back to Connor Lamb for just a moment. He represents the 17th District, which serves the northwestern suburbs of Pittsburgh. He's been floated as a potential contender for the U.S. Senate seat now held by, you know, retiring Republican Pat Toomey. If Lamb does run, does this change the political calculation for cartographers?
That could solve a problem, quite honestly. Thanks for getting out of the way, Connor. Say goodbye to your district. That depends. I mean, if Lamb says he's not going to run for re-election, is going to go all in for U.S. Senate, which is, you know, should be the right thing to do, and which is typically what happens. That could make it a little bit easier for map makers to rejigger things out there in the Pittsburgh suburbs.
John Micek is editor-in-chief of the Penn Capital Star, and we are discussing the fact that according to the latest U.S. Census, Pennsylvania will lose a congressional seat ahead of the 2022 elections. So, John, it doesn't seem as if any of this is going to affect southeastern Pennsylvania.
Southeastern Pennsylvania continues to be a grower, and even into the Lehigh Valley, Mary, which continues to be a burgeoning area as well. It doesn't seem likely that those seats will be impacted particularly.
So back to one of your earlier observations, you know, the fact that the congressional delegation will shrink by one, you know, didn't come as a surprise to many observers. In fact, you know, because, there has been an issue with population stability in the state. It grew very slowly over the last decade in Pennsylvania. What does this say about the attraction of Pennsylvania to businesses and newcomers?
You know, they've been having this conversation for as long as I've been covering state politics, trying to keep young people here, trying to make the state more attractive to businesses. I mean, we have the second oldest population in the nation behind Florida, in large part because we don't tax retirement income. So that's seen as a haven for a lot of folks who are looking to retire here. But this remains a continuous and ongoing challenge for policymakers. You keep hearing these conversations about how to stem the brain drain, how to keep young people in Pennsylvania after they graduate college. The Wolf administration, and you're talking to my friend Sue Snyder, just previously, the Wolf administration is floating this plan to give grants to young people who go to the state system schools and to get them to stay in the state for the same number of years as they accept grant money from the state as a way to sort of keep people down on the farm. It's a tremendous challenge. The state only grew by 2.4% over the last decade, and that is pretty anemic. And while it's growth, it still wasn't enough to stem losing a congressional seat.
And Pennsylvania will also lose one electoral vote. I mean, it has been a swing state prize in Pennsylvania elections. Does dropping back to 19 electoral votes change the Commonwealth's clout at all as we look ahead to 2024?
I mean, it's still a pretty decent sized size. I mean, 19 electoral votes is, I mean, 19 electoral votes is still nothing to sneeze at. It ain't 20, but it's still enough. The bigger underlying question here, of course, is what this does to the allocation of federal money. And that's, you know, that's the big driver of the census. Will Pennsylvania, for instance, get less for highway projects or schools or social welfare or whatever? I mean, so that's sort of the underlying, you know, big policy worry beneath any diminution of political clout on Capitol Hill or in the Electoral College.
So the census data came about 4 months late, in part because of the pandemic. Does this mean, John Micek, there will be an increased urgency to get redistricting done? And if so, what might be the fallout to an accelerated process?
We're already seeing this here at the state level. Last week, Mary, when the Legislative Reapportionment Commission met for the first time to try to find its fifth member chairman, this is the panel that redraws the state's 253 House and Senate districts, a process that's separate and apart from the congressional remap. But more than one lawmaker on that panel remarked on the urgency and the compressed time schedules. Theoretically, there could be a rush to get a map done, and maybe somebody, you know, fudges a line or something like that. It just increases the odds, I think, that this is, you know, it almost always gets litigated. This will just simply increase the odds that the maps will get litigated.
So what, just as an aside, let's just look at the Legislative Reapportionment Commission for just a moment. What happens next in the recruitment of a chairperson?
So they had 2 days of public interviews, Monday and Tuesday of last week. They heard from 41 candidates from across the state.
And they're not supposed to be politically affiliated, right?
They're not supposed to be politically affiliated. They ought not to have political ambitions if they've run from if they ran for office, pardon me, there should be some significant remove from the last time of that candidacy. And then almost like clockwork on Friday of last week, the commission announced in about 4:30 in the afternoon that it had failed to come to consensus on a fifth chairperson and was kicking the decision to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, which now has until May 30th to name that person. And that's the same thing that happened in 2011, the last time we went through this exercise. Very hard for four people from the two separate caucuses in the House and Senate to come to consensus. And I don't think there was any particular surprise that it got kicked to the Supreme Court. Although you did have some folks drive in from great distance to interview on Monday and Tuesday of last week, so they might have thought they could have saved on some gas money, I suppose.
Well, and as time is of the essence, again, this whole process is pushed back by a month.
Exactly.
If the Supreme Court takes until the end of the month. Okay. Let's talk about the contentious 2020 election, the presidential election. Will this be a shadow, a presence of sorts in the congressional redistricting process in Pennsylvania?
It's funny. I'm so concentrated on the primary that's coming up that I haven't started thinking ahead to 2022 that much. But yeah. You know, invariably you're going to have partisan politics. They try to remove partisanship from this, but this is invariably a highly partisan process. We're going through right now in the state legislature a look at election and voting reforms being driven by the Republican majority there. I think the specter of the 2020 election is hanging over this municipal primary, and it will invariably hang over the 2022 race as well.
Well, yeah, and speaking of politics and the state Supreme Court, you know, appellate judges are elected in Pennsylvania. We discussed this just a few weeks ago on the roundup. The state Supreme Court, again, is Democrat majority. Republicans are still smarting from the decision about the last map. And so there is now a legislative proposal to elect appellate judges by district as opposed to statewide elections. John Micek, do you see this proposal gaining real traction? And if it's implemented, is this pivotal for the GOP in Pennsylvania?
It would make a bad system even worse. In my judgment, I've always been of the opinion that's a terrible idea to treat judges like political candidates and make them raise money and run for office. And we could spend an entire program talking about that. This would be a proposed constitutional amendment, Mary, and I forget where it is in the pipeline. I think it's already gotten one go through in one legislative session and would need to get passage in this legislative session. But I think they ran out the clock on that one. But this is something that would make a lot of difference for Republicans, because it would be a dilution of sort of the political influence of Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, which is where most appellate court judges tend to come from. And that's why you saw so much pushback from legislative Democrats to this proposal.
Okay, we've got some questions. Mike asks, what does your guest think of the role of Philadelphia, which is the city of meds and eds, in attracting and keeping people in the state? And is there something more the city can do?
Wow, that's a fantastic question. Certainly we've seen both Pittsburgh and Philadelphia becoming magnets for young people. Pittsburgh has the similar sort of meds and eds, along with a very vigorous technology sector because of the presence of Carnegie Mellon University. Far be it for me to prescribe what city officials ought to do to attract more people to the city. I would think that when you're living in an apartment the size of your car and it's $1,500 a month, that can be a disincentive. I mean, certainly there should be some help for young people for housing or more affordable housing. Certainly there's no shortage cultural options and going out options.
And this question from Dave, what does your guest think of Madeline Dean's seat? Her district was created by the courts. Do you think her district could be axed? What are your thoughts, John?
Again, I think it's going to be hands off on, and you and I were talking about this a minute ago, I think it's going to be hands off on Southeastern Pennsylvania hands off on the Philly burbs. We've had Dean's name has been floated for for the U.S. Senate, as has Chrissy Houlihan's down there in the 6th district. If one or the other of them were to jump in, that could potentially change the calculus. Maybe you'd see some dropping and dragging here and there. But I sort of feel like the 4th CD is, that's Dean's seat, is a safe one.
Okay, thanks for those questions. And activists, John Micek, have long lobbied for an independent commission to oversee the redistricting process. Have we seen any movement toward this forward in recent years?
There was discussion and debate on it in last year's legislative session, and it just kind of disappeared and died. Activists were agitating for it again this year, but obviously it's not going to happen. We've had this conversation, I feel like, every redistricting round for the last 20 years, Mary, where there's been the suggestion of an independent commission taking it out of the hands of politicians and putting it in the hands of citizens, as is the case, I think, in Arizona and California. But they just never seem to be able to get it over the goal line. The closest you have, I think, is a proposal by Senator Dave Argel, Republican of Schuylkill County, that would ban anybody who is running for office from serving as the 5th independent member of the Legislative Reapportionment Commission. But that is as close as we seem to have quivered to reform. And I think that bill cleared committee. I don't recall if it's gotten the floor vote yet or not.
All right. Lots more to talk about. And I'm sure we'll be addressing this on future shows, regional roundups. John Micek, great to have you with us as always.
Thanks so much.
John Micek is editor-in-chief of the Pennsylvania Capital Star. Stay with us on the regional roundup. We've got poet and Pennsylvania, University of Pennsylvania professor Fatima Shams with us. She'll talk about her new book, A Revolution in Rhyme, which explores the role that poetry plays in politics in a complicated modern-day Iran. That's next. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Fatima Shams is an award-winning poet, an assistant professor of Persian literature at the University of Pennsylvania, and a woman living in exile. Her family was imprisoned during the 2009 government crackdown in Iran, and as protests unfurled following the controversial presidential election there that year, Shams was struck by the sight of state-sponsored poets reading and conversing with Iran's supreme leader on television in, as she puts it, a disturbingly peaceful and carefully controlled environment. It was as if nothing was happening in the streets. Shams' new book, A Revolution in Rhyme, Poetic Co-option Under the Islamic Republic, examines the role state-sponsored poets play in the discourse of resistance. And Fatima Shams is with us for the rest of the hour on the Regional Roundup. Welcome.
Hi, Mary. Thank you for having me here.
I'd like to start with a bit of background. You were born in Iran and in the early 1980s, a few years after the Islamic Revolution. Tell us a bit about your youth and how you came to discover and embrace poetry.
I was born in 1983 in the peak of Iran-Iraq War in Iran, and I was raised there. I went to school there, and this book in many ways is based on my firsthand experience of the official literary narrative of Iran, from my early exposure to poetry in school textbooks, to watching official televised poetry nights hosted by the supreme leader, who is also a poet himself, although it's not an aspect of his life that is usually highlighted, especially outside Iran. And also discovering banned books and hearing accounts of life before the revolution and the poetry that was used as propaganda in the past. So all of this really led me to sort of fixate on a crucial question, that why and how have only some poets made their ways onto school curriculums and poetry festivals and national broadcasts, while others that in most of the cases were also of a much higher caliber have basically been rendered invisible. And that brought me to write this book.
As a youth, as a young woman, you found your mother's hidden poetry books, which had been banned by the government, and again realized those poets were not included in your studies at school. What effect did these books have on you?
The effect was pretty deep. I think the most important effect was that at a very young age, I realized that there is a dual life, not just for the citizens who live under the Islamic Republic, but also for the literary output and production. I was already aware that poetry was very much at the core of the Iranian life, but at a young age, I didn't know how much it also affects the governance and the politics in Iran. The people of Iran really encounter poetry every day in newspapers, in classrooms, in religious sermons, political broadcasts, advertising billboards, television, radio, and at home. But this poetry that is so deeply embedded in the culture also plays such an important role in the ruling structures in Iran. And years after I left Iran and sort of pursued my higher education, I realized that this role has not been explored by the former academics, who mostly were purged and exiled after the revolution. So mm-hmm. there was a rupture in the scholarship that I wanted to address.
What did this purging involve? Do you know?
It goes back to the Cultural Revolution that happened in early 1980s. And the secular academics and those with leftist leanings were purged during those years. And many of them had to leave the country. And they are among the first generation of the scholars who have written about the 1979 revolution and the literary production before the revolution. But the gap really was where most of these scholars these scholars could not address was the post-revolutionary period, simply because they did not have that lived experience under the Islamic Republic. They didn't experience the educational system there. They didn't see their school textbooks. So I felt, as someone who actually had this firsthand experience with an interest in poetry and literature, it would be interesting to actually contribute to the field by bringing a narrative that is missing in the scholarship already.
So during the unrest in 2009, as you referenced earlier, there were huge protests in the street, and at the same time, state-sponsored poetry was being mm-hmm. read, recited on television. What was going through your mind as you were watching this? What were your thoughts?
Yeah, that's a very good question. You know, those poetry nights have been happening for at least two decades now. And I remember I was a PhD student at Oxford, residing in the United Kingdom at the time, and I was watching those poets reciting their poems in the national TV, in the state TV, and sort of responding to the protests in the streets. But what I was really, in a way, fascinated but at the same time disturbed by was that this environment and this televised show is so carefully put together and controlled, as if nothing is really happening in the streets. And suddenly, it really resonated with me in the sense that, you know, as a scholar of Persian literature and a student of Persian literature, I knew that there was a very intimate and close tie between the poets and the patrons since the pre-Islamic period in the Persian court. And poets actually fulfilled crucial duties and enjoyed a highly privileged position. They were the vital source of knowledge and education for the Persian kings, and there were, you know, these occasional events where poets went to the patrons and read poetry to them and received money in exchange or security and safety was really a model that existed for centuries in Iran. And I saw that, and I felt like this is basically the invention of the same tradition, but in a completely different environment and a different part, like historical epoch. So that became one of the major sources of inspiration for me to write this book, to also connect the present to the past and to look at these patterns that are patterns of continuity. Because as far as the 1979 revolution is concerned, there is always this assumption that the revolution itself was a rupture in the history of the country, and nothing that happened before the revolution has anything to do with what happened after the revolution. In the book, I'm trying to challenge this. Actually, I've tried to challenge this assumption to show that how these patterns of continuity still exist if we look closely at the relationship between the poets and the seat of power.
So in this case, the seat of power, the government of Iran, was the patron. Correct?
Yes.
Was, in effect, was this weaponizing poetry?
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, this is a case that one thing that I think it's important to also understand in relation to this particular topic is that the relationship between literature and politics has really a long history of scholarship in the West.
Sure.
And this topic has been explored in other cultures, such as Soviet Russia, Franco's Spain, Castro's Cuba, or Italy under Mussolini, where the role of the poet tyrant has been critically investigated. And I was very much inspired by studies of Soviet writing in the book. I use Soviet writing as Soviet literature as a shadow case in the book. And I was really surprised to discover how little has been explored about the role that literature, particularly poetry, plays in the Islamic Republic. So in a way, by focusing on these and these state-sponsored literary institutions and poets and this presence of elegy-making industry, indoctrination programs in the schools and universities, I wanted to put Iran on the global map to show that there is this close relationship, similar pattern that we see in other contexts also exist in Iran.
So I'd like to get to some poems from A Revolution in Rhyme in just a moment. But I'd also like to point out too, Fatima, that as all this was happening in 2009, your family were imprisoned, correct?
I'm a practicing poet myself. So I think that had a huge impact on writing this book, and also on the sort of challenges that me and my parents and my sister and some of my very close friends and other family members experienced. I think the fact that poetry could still be considered as a tool of resistance, not just for the state-sponsored poets, but also for poets in exile and dissident poets, and also those who, reside in the country but continue writing poetry and end up in prisons. It shows how much poetry still matters to the everyday politics in Iran. In 2009, I was a frequent blogger, and I had a poetry blog for many years, and I continued writing in that blog. The blog was completely destroyed by the government three times, and I continued writing. At some point, I decided to publish my collections. So all three collections that I published have been published outside the country, of course.
So since we're up against the clock, let's get to at least one poem from A Revolution in Rhyme. And this is from a poet who is sanctioned by the state of Iran. A poem for war. Could you read that for us, please?
Yeah, absolutely. Just a very brief point about this poem is that the poem really falls into the realist war poetry, which is, of course, a literary phenomenon that exists also in the West. The British First World War poets, such as Rupert Brooke, Wilfred Owen, and Sassoon, have written in the same sort of style. The poem is by Qaisar Aminpour, and it was written after the siege of Khorramshahr in 1980. I read only one part of the poem since it's a very long poem.
Okay.
I sat in our city once again. The walls are covered with photographs of tulips. Here, the state of high alert never wanes. It is the siren of red alert that whimpers on. Alone in the quiet of the night, over the never-ending sleep of corpses, the enemy's savage vampires seek the light that leaks through the pinhole. We must cover the orioles with blind curtains. Here, even the walls are no longer a shelter. They're upright graves waiting for the night.
So who is the enemy the author is referring to in this poem?
Well, here, this is a poem that is written in response to, as I mentioned, to the Iraqi troops taking over one of the key cities in Iran during the war with Iraq, which happened between 1980 and 1988. So here, enemy is considered to be the troops of the neighboring country.
And do you consider the poems, what are your thoughts about the poets in this book? I mean, they are sanctioned by the state. Is this, frankly, good poetry overall, in your opinion?
So, you know, this is also a brilliant question, in the sense that one thing that I have tried to show in the book is that it's really not such a black and white argument to say that this poet, like the poems that are written by these poets, should be all littered as bad poetry or terrible poetry, mm-hmm. Or ideologically charged poetry. But on the other hand, the way that this, you know, it is to a large extent propaganda poetry, and I argue this in the book that, of course, from the aesthetic point of view. Many of literary critics who are in favor of and fond of high literature, they might actually not like this kind of poetry. But I think what's important is that we understand that sometimes there is also value and significance and relevance in poetry when it comes to politics and political legitimacy. It's not so much about the aesthetics, but it's about the effect and the impact that these kind of poems might have on the collective memory of a nation. Many Iranians who grow up under the Islamic Republic, even if they disagree with the ideological system, they find themselves remembering these poems, these war poems and songs of revolution, no matter how they feel about them. So, and that is important to me, that collective memory.
We've got about 30 seconds left, but I understand that your next book, I believe, will be about the experience of women writers, which is not possible in the first book. Why not?
The second book, hopefully, is going to be about the exilic writing. And yes, I am planning to write about women and their experience in writing as a form of exilic writing, hopefully.
Well, Fatima Shams, it was such a pleasure.
Having...
Thank you so much for spending some time with us. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Fatima Shams. Oh, you're very welcome. Fatima Shams is a professor of Persian literature at the University of Pennsylvania and author of A Revolution in Rhyme, Poetic Co-option Under the Islamic Republic. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producer is John Ahrens, along with some help from Kelsey Hansen today. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for listening. Be well.